Thank you very much, sir. My remarks, in a way, complement those that Ramesh has just presented, looking at R2P in a macro sense, because another area of protection, which is actually very important in international relations, relates to the protection of those people who may be fleeing a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons that have been encoded in instruments like the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees. This problem, the problem of individual apprehension about persecution, is also something which sits in an institutional context. In a way, the very existence of a Westphalian system of sovereign states sets the scene for the phenomenon of the refugee to emerge and to be explored. One of the reasons for this is that if one seeks moral justifications for the territorial state as a political unit, one of the stronger that one can put forward is what the philosopher Robert Gooden has called the assigned responsibility model, in which states serve to protect those who are designated as citizens of the states, and this protective role provides the state with a moral justification. What we know from history, however, is that many states fail to do so. Some actively persecute their own citizens, others fail to develop the capacity or lose the capacity to provide the kind of protection that people need. And that is one of the principal reasons why people flee as refugees, to seek in other parts of the world the safety that the assigned responsibility model of the state has denied them in the territories that normally should provide them with assistance. Ramesh and I have just co-edited a book called Theorizing the Responsibility to Protect, and in that I have a rather detailed discussion of the risk, theoretical at the moment, fortunately, that states might cite a disposition to act under R2P as a basis for soft-pedaling their responsibilities to refugees on an individual basis. But I think that's something that we need to watch with a certain amount of care, because to the extent that we have an international refugee crisis at the moment, I don't think it's because of the numbers per se, but it's rather because of the reluctance of quite a large number of states actually to discharge in good faith the responsibilities towards refugees that they historically accepted when they ratified or acceded to international instruments. And if one seeks to explore what the basis might be of state responsibilities towards refugees, there are actually a number that come to mind. And one is simply that, to the extent that refugees are victims of systemic failure in a system from which many states are happy to continue to enjoy advantages, those who are happy to harvest these advantages arguably owe responsibilities to those whom the system has failed. Now, that's a rather abstract kind of argument, but from the point of view of the United Nations, the much more concrete basis for responsibilities towards refugees arise from international law. And then one of the more widely ratified instruments of international law is indeed the 1951 Convention and its 1967 Protocol, which gave it expanded and global writ. And beyond this, the United Nations, through the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which has its own constitutive statute and now has a time-unlimited mandate from the General Assembly, plays a very important role as custodian of the norms of international refugee law and refugee protection more broadly. And in order to get a sense of what that family of norms involves, it may be important not simply to look at the text of the 1951 Convention and the 1967 Protocol, but also the soft law resolutions that have emerged since November 1957, when the Executive Committee of the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was established and took on the role of developing a range of principles that should come into play when the protection of refugees is in prospect. And UNHCR, I think, has had a very distinguished history since it was established more than 60 years ago of not only providing immediate assistance to people in circumstances of dire disadvantage, but also in promoting durable solutions to refugee problems such as voluntary repatriation in safe circumstances, integration in countries of first asylum, or, where necessary, resettlement to other parts of the world. But UNHCR is a conflicted organisation in two specific senses. One is that as its emergency relief responsibilities have mounted, its dependence on voluntary contributions from states has exposed it to pressures from states whose funding stream may be very important in enabling it to meet emergency relief responsibilities, but which do not want to see UNHCR particularly active in ensuring that those donor states also provide adequate protection to people who appear at their borders and seek asylum. And we've seen a lot of tension that UNHCR has confronted in that respect down through the years. And more broadly, to the extent that UNHCR assists the process of resettlement, there is now a dramatic discrepancy between the number of resettlement places that wealthy states are making available and the number of individuals whom UNHCR has assessed as being in dire need of rapid resettlement. And we're talking there about a discrepancy on a very large scale indeed, about 900,000 people assessed as being in dire need and between 80 and 90,000 resettlement places being made available globally in recent years. And I'll come back to the ramifications of that in just a moment. This is but one reflection of the deeper problem of states seeking to escape the responsibilities to which they've voluntarily committed in the past. And we've seen a number of different bases for this. One argument is that states have a democratic obligation to admit only as many people as their existing populations would accept, which creates real issues about how international law and democratic systems might come into conflict with each other. Another argument is to the effect that by agreeing to resettle a certain number of people from other parts of the world, states should implicitly be entitled to reject those who seek asylum or protection at the border. This is an almost entirely spurious line of argument, since there's nothing whatever in the 1951 Convention that says that a voluntary contribution of resettlement places should be a basis for washing one's hands of specific responsibilities to which the Convention gives rise. There is, I think, also a reason to be sceptical about resettlement as a wider practice of states. The pure problem here being that states may resettle people not because they are in the direst need, but because they have other political calculations that come into mind in determining who should be resettled. And it can be tempting to see refugee resettlement as a kind of skilled migration program and to cherry pick refugee camps for English-speaking engineers and doctors rather than identify the non-literate rape victims who may be in the greatest of need. And we've also seen cases in which what are nominally refugee resettlement places have been available only for people who don't have disabilities or for people who have sponsors already in the countries to which they're seeking to be resettled. And neither of those at all has anything to do with need. If anything, you can argue that excluding the disabled is something which strikes at the heart of the neediest refugees. Domestic politics, in other words, should never be discounted as a factor which shapes the way in which states approach these matters. And I think, in a way, the most gruesome manifestation of that comes when we hear politicians in a country like Australia saying that attempting, in effect, to close the borders is a device for saving lives at sea. And there, if you go to WikiLeaks, an interesting source, although not one would want to see corroding diplomacy every week of the year, you find that in November 2009, an American embassy cable back to Washington recounted that a senior strategist of what is now the government in Australia said to the US embassy that the arrival of boats with unauthorized entrance was, quote, fantastic, and the more boats that come, the better. So under those circumstances, when I hear politicians now claim that all they're interested in doing is saving lives at sea, I basically want to throw up. And the mismatch between the number of resettlement places available internationally and the number actually required provides the fundamental explanation of why people smuggling has emerged as a phenomenon in the times in which we're living. That anyone who's done Economics 1 can explain that if you have a good in great demand which is not being adequately met, a black market will emerge to provide that particular service. And frankly, if I were in dire circumstances, I wouldn't want a state bureaucracy to have to rescue me, because we know from a range of grim historical examples that that's all too unlikely to happen. If we look at some of the heroic people who have resettled refugees in the 20th century, we think of people like Sugihara, the Japanese consul in Kaunas in Lithuania, who against the wishes of the Japanese government gave thousands of Japanese visas to Jewish refugees who were then able to use those to get through Russia and make their way to safety in other countries. We think of people like Varian Fryer from the European Rescue Committee in the south of France in 1940 and 1941, whose efforts to rescue refugees from Nazi Germany were actively opposed by the US State Department, which at that time had diplomatic relations with the Vichy regime of Marshal Pétain, and which explicitly disavowed the efforts of Fry, who managed to rescue people like Hannah Arendt and Marcel Duchamp and a whole range of luminous figures in European culture. I'm haunted by the account of William Russell in a book called Berlin Embassy from 1941 of a US official in Berlin telling a little old lady whose husband was in the concentration camp at Dachau that his quota number was so remote that it would be at least 8 years before he could contemplate resettlement by the United States. In other words, one should be very wary of relying on state bureaucracies to rescue one, and this is one of the dilemmas that UNHCR faces just at the moment. This, I think, has been augmented by an issue which raises greater human rights issues for the UN system than those that simply arise from refugee law. And this relates to the use of deterrent mechanisms to try to prevent people from making use of refugee rights that have been mentioned in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and then encoded in the 1951 Convention. And I think it's worth stating very bluntly here that when states set out to deter people from seeking refugee protection, what is central to that is that people have a rotten time, that they be mistreated. And I'm always a little worried when we draw attention to things like abuse on Nauru, that we may inadvertently be doing exactly what the minister wants, that advocates' words may be put into brochures suggesting that terrible things happen to you if you come to a place like that, because in a way that's exactly the message that the government is trying to get back to people. I think there's a more deeply corrosive aspect of these kinds of deterrent practices, though, which relate to the polity as well as to the international system. Offshore detention of asylum seekers is a device to avoid accountability through the courts, and anybody witnessing the orchestrated litany of lies that some witnesses have been producing to the Senate committee hearing on Nauru at the moment should be very uneasy about what exactly is involved when one engages in the vicarious dirty hands policy of outsourcing the running of such places to private commercial organisations. And of course it can be lethal in its consequences, as we saw in the case of Reza Barati, who was clubbed over the head with a rock in Manus, with no one yet having been convicted of that particular offence. There's a final sense in which I think the polity is corrupted, and that arises when the values that should be implicit in the approach to these sorts of issues on the part of states that are seeking to evade their responsibility are more broadly corroded. And we saw this in 2001 with the signing of the first administrative arrangement between Australia and Nauru, in which one of the elements of that document was a commitment on the part of the Australian government to pay unpaid hospital bills of Nauruan citizens. Now, if you commit yourself in the future to pay the hospital bills of the population of a particular country, you could call that an aid program. But if you actually take steps to relieve specified individuals of the burden of private debts that they've acquired in the past, that's a bribe. It's frankly no different to passing somebody a bag of money under the table with a wink, and this, of course, was radically at odds with the good governance agenda that a country like Australia was appropriately pursuing in the Pacific at the time. So I think the whole issue of asylum and asylum seekers is throwing up a challenge at the moment. And it's a challenge on two fronts. At one level, it's a challenge for the architecture that has been meticulously developed over quite a long period of time to try to deal with people whose vulnerabilities are a challenge to the conscience of mankind. But it is also a challenge to the kind of state that we and other Western polities would claim to be. And I think one of the things that disturbs me is that we're proving ourselves to be no better than the absolute worst. Thank you very much.